Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Washington podcast with your host, Vincent Cavallari.
Sink these shoes, quit clocking down some dead end street. Take these shoes and make them fit.
Well, good day to everyone. Good day and welcome to another episode of the Mill Creek View podcast. And I'm your host, Mill Creek City Councilman Vincent Cavallari. As always, we are excited to have you with us and happy to be here as well. We invite you to check us out. Please subscribe, like us, comment, write us, whatever you choose. We'd love to hear from you, but do subscribe, please. We promise to make this a good use of your valuable time. And as always, in keeping with that same promise, it's our mission to continue to bring you great guests. Guests with their fingers on the pulse of your community, people you want to hear from, and people that you need to hear from, and tonight's guest is no different. Washington State Representative J.T. Wilcox will be joining us, and we are, of course, excited to have him on, and we'll, of course, bring him on in just a few moments. And remember, here at the Mill Creek View podcast, our mission is quite simple. Is to always to endeavor to make this a place where dialogue and debate will thrive and survive. And the truth will always have a home. And that, of course, is my eternal pledge to all of you. Friends, there's no disputing that government affects every aspect of the people's lives. From what we eat, to the education we receive, to the water we drink, to the air we breathe. Even what we do in our free time is affected by government in one way or another. Far too many people lack an understanding of the role government plays in their everyday lives. I'll wager that if you ask most people, they'll probably tell you that they believe the President of the United States has the biggest impact on their daily lives. And I'll bet a third of them have no idea who the actual president is. Most people simply don't understand the critical role of local, state, and city government and the impact it has on them and their families. In fact, most people won't even show up to vote in local elections compared to, let's say, a presidential election. Friends, in the last 20 years, local governments have gained increasing responsibilities for the caretaking of its communities and the public's well-being. Yet attention to local government lags in understanding among the people. And friends, that's just plain dangerous. Fewer than 40% of the people in your community will vote in local elections, as compared to, let's say, the office of president, where 70, 80% of the population will show up and cast a ballot. And the lack of voter participation is a direct cause of all the decay in Democrat cities and states. You see, we elect these individuals to represent our needs on city councils and state legislatures, and they're responsible for things like the imposition of taxes that pay for public education, police and fire, public works, roads and bridges, and far too many other things to actually list. So where am I going with all of this? My question is to you. My question is to the electorate. Why isn't this of the utmost importance to everyone? Why isn't electing honest, well-intentioned public servants like tonight's guest a top priority for you? What happened to being an informed citizen? For years, there's been a steady decline in voting at the local level, and personally, I just can't fathom why. So I just have to ask a couple of questions. Is it a lack of understanding? I mean, that's possible. Is it a lack of caring? That's also possible. Or God forbid, is it a lack of hope? Friends, I hope that that is not the case, because we can never lose hope on America, because by all definitions, America is hope. We are going to take a quick break and we'll be right back, so please don't go away. When we come back, J.T. Wilcox, the former House Minority Leader, will be joining us, and it's going to be another great show. So stay tuned, buckle up. We will be right back. Friends, the way we grow this show is through you. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends, like us, share us. Tell us what you want to hear. Tell us what you want to see. Tell us how we're doing. Tell us everything. Just keep on tuning in and please subscribe. We promise to make this an informative use of your valuable time. Stick around. We'll be right back. How much money's in the bank? It's all about the time we spend and those we have to thank. Thank all those good guys and gals for being such good friends. Baby, that's what it's all about. Till the bitter end. It's only money, not worth the paper it's printed on. It has no friends, welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for sticking around, and I promise you won't be disappointed. Tonight's guest is a fourth-generation Washingtonian who was born in Yelm and grew up on his family farm in Pierce County. Over 100 years ago, the Wilcox family settled along the banks of the Nisqually River and started their family farm, which is today one of the largest family-owned businesses in the state and a major employer in the region. He graduated from Washington State University with his bachelor's degree in history. And in 2011, he was sworn in as state representative in Washington's 2nd District, which covers areas of Pierce and Thurston County. He is a Republican lawmaker and has served as the House Minority Leader in Olympia for many years. He won 6 consecutive re-election bids to his current House seat. But breaking news tonight, he is not seeking a re-election this year. He recently announced his retirement in March of this year, just a few weeks ago. He and his wife, Kathy, have raised 3 wonderful children and still currently reside in Yelm, Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Mill Creek View podcast, Representative J.T. Wilcox. Welcome, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. How's the family? How's things down south, as they say?
Well, things are good. We got a new grandson last week, so super
wow.
Excited about that. Our son Jimmy and his wife Azra broke the pattern. He's not James Truman Wilcox V, but we're super happy to have him anyway.
So as long as they're happy and he's healthy, I mean, that's all we care about. So I was a mold breaker, too. I was a Vincent Joseph Cavalieri III, and I broke the mold when I called my son Joshua Vincent Cavalieri. So traditions are meant to be carried on, but maybe not in all cases. But either way, congrats. Congrats on the being a grandparent. Is that the first grandchild?
No, that's we've got a 7-year-old granddaughter who's already helping me cut firewood and working on the farm after school a lot of days.
Oh, very nice, very nice. Well, I mean, you mentioned the farm. I think that's probably a great place to start. I mean, as I mentioned in the intro, you and your family have a very large farm down south in where you're at in Yelm, and how is the farm doing? How is farming in America today?
Well, you know, we call it the farm, a lot of us live on the farm or adjacent to it, but our business is around the Pacific Northwest. We have locations in Washington, Oregon, Alaska, Idaho and Montana, and market to Alaska and some other states. And a lot of what we do is food processing. And I talk to people about the food business, because you can't just be a farmer anymore, especially if you live on the West Coast. You know, farming traditionally has been a commodity business. And to be competitive as a commodity producer, you have to be a low-cost producer. And the truth is, it's pretty tough to be a low-cost producer along the coast. We have created a business environment that is pretty high cost. And so, like farmers have done since the dawn of time, we've adapted. And instead of trying to produce the greatest number of of eggs at the cheapest possible price. What we do now is we try to capture as much added value as we possibly can. And the funny thing is, it's very much like politics. You're seeking people that are willing to vote with their dollars when you match up with their values. And that's what we do. We have a lot of organic products. We have free range. We have what we call mobile pasture, and none of these are cheap. But we couldn't be in business if all we did was sell cheap things. And I think that's true for a lot of ag, especially in Western Washington and up and down the coast. It's going to be increasingly true, I think, as people try to figure out how do you survive in the food business? How do you provide something that's good for not just your own generation, but future generations? And it's not going to be just doing exactly what your grandparents did.
How tough is it to be, we're going to say farmer, it encompasses everything. How tough is it to be a farmer in Washington State? I mean, is it over taxation that makes it so grueling, or
Regulations.
Well, I think that first of all, farmers have long planning horizons. And you can use that to be successful. You can also use that to lock yourself into business strategies that are not going to work in the long run. And the thing that my family has done, and my son, by the way, is our corporate controller, and he's the fifth generation to survive farming here. We've always identified as farmers and people in the food business, but we've also always identified as people that might be doing a different kind of food or a different kind of farming. In the future. And we've gotten in and out of some businesses. I felt like I grew up as a dairy farmer, but that is not really a business that has a future, I think, in Western Washington. And I have friends that are out of that business and other friends that are struggling. So we have to look hard for the opportunities that are there and deploy our assets, our land, and our family qualities. Those are our major assets, along with the people that have been with us, some of them for generations now, towards the things that will make us successful. And it may not even be eggs in the future. So what makes it hard? Well, I think it's absolutely true that regulations have made a lot of things difficult. I'm not against lots of regulations. I have evolved. I'm 61 years old. And I remember when my dad came home from a meeting with Billy Frank and said, JT, our friends in the Nisqually tribe downstream feel like we are damaging their fish runs. And I don't want to ever see us polluting the Nisqually River. So we're going to do some things differently. And we've done that. Sometimes that was just because we knew it was right. Other times it was because regulations required it. And I'm not against things that make a qualitative difference for people downstream. But we also, I think, have a never-ending cascade of problems that maybe apply to a few people, but the solutions get applied across the board. And often it seems like we ignore the people that are the real bad actors and regulate and enforce with the people that are doing their best to do the right thing. So that's a problem. Taxation for the ag business is not a real burden in this state. We pay taxes, no question about that. And certainly, if you're someone in processing, you pay the full rate on all of the land improvements and buildings that you do. I would say that we're like almost every other business. We have a climate in Washington that, you can't point to one single thing, but just some examples. We ship products all over about 10 states, and what we have done in Washington now with the cost of diesel fuel has made it very difficult to be competitive with other states, and it's made it harder to ship products longer distance. And that's not just the eggs that we might be sending over to Montana or down to San Francisco. It's all of the commodities that we bring to our feed mills that are necessary to keep the chickens fed. And that probably is the most impactful things that's happened over the last few years.
And in fairness to you, you've spearheaded legislation in the House to protect land and water rights and clean air and clean water. So it's not like you're just abusing the land for to make a buck. So but are we doing enough? Is there enough being done to protect this field of endeavor, the American farmer, the American family farmers?
You know, that's a hard one for me to answer because I grew up in an era where we didn't want help. We wanted the ability to stand on our own 2 feet, you know, select our destiny and then do everything that we could to achieve that. And, you know, we also kind of grew up in an era where if things didn't work out, you didn't complain a lot. And I mentioned that we've changed our business plan a lot. The hardest thing that Dad and I have ever had to do was decide that the dairy business wasn't going to work and stand in front of a bunch of people and, you know, tell them that we weren't going to be able to employ them in milk processing anymore. So, you know, we have to be ready for mistakes and failure, and we don't have to expect the rest of society to bail us out. But, you know, I think we do want to ask those that are in charge, and you know that I've been in the minority my whole 14 years in the legislature. We expect the people that are in charge to listen and carefully weigh the consequences of what they do. And I can think of so many examples of times when, in response to a poorly understood problem, a whole bunch of people that were not part of the problem ending up paying the price. And one example might be the extension of overtime regulations to ag. Didn't affect Wilcox Farms because we paid time and a half to our staff, whether we were required to or not. But it made a big impact in Eastern Washington, where you don't have steady work all the time. You have these periods that are critical for harvest. And people that work in orchards and people that own orchards understood, we're going to get you as many hours as we possibly can. This is how you make a living. A lot of their staff go back to Mexico during part of the year. And so they understood that they were going to have some long, long hours here. And it was a system that worked. Well, the Democrats passed an extension of labor law that destroyed that system. And what's happening now is people are being forced, in order to control their costs, to hold people to 40 hours instead of the 50 or 60 that happened for a few weeks a year. And the result has been, in some cases, fruit that goes to waste because it's not economical to pick it anymore. And in other cases, people just not making the money that they used to make. And the workers in this case are the ones that are trying to come back to Olympia and tell urban legislators, thank you for trying. It doesn't work. Could you please let us go back to a system that really did work for us? That's the kind of thing that I find super frustrating, especially when there are people that are perfectly willing with goodwill to provide the right answer, and then they're treated with suspicion.
I mean, isn't that the very definition of the seasonal worker, right? The part-time worker that comes in and they pick for a season. But Democrats don't realize the damage or the cascading effect that they inflict going downhill. Don't forget, these folks bring that come, you mentioned Mexico, that come to our country, come to the state of Washington, and they provide a service, and they provide for their families back home, and they provide for their economies back home, and some of the economies here. And so most of their policies, I find a lot of fault with, and just it seems to really lack any basis of thought in the very beginning. But how has Wilcox Farms, and I'm not going to keep beating you up on the farms. I mean, I was really curious. I was telling Steve, you've been around so long. How have you guys managed to thrive and survive when others haven't?
Well, I think, can I just go back for a second? I want to make one more point. We have an elected representative who is a Republican, maybe that's why they don't listen to him, named Alex Ibarra, who grew up in a farm worker family. And went to college thanks to some great teachers. His brothers now own small orchards. He knows exactly what this situation is And because he was a Republican, nobody would listen to him. If they don't want to listen to a middle-aged chubby white guy farmer like me, that's fine. But Alex Ibarra, for crying out loud, he lived that and no one would listen to him. Very frustrating. But going back to your question here, I think the quality that we've been able to cling to over these generations is the idea that your business is going to have to change. And sometimes it changes real fast. You can get a call from a major customer saying that they're going to make a change. You can have a food safety crisis that threatens your reputation. And you just cannot be stubborn. You've got to make sure that your priority is always we're going to recognize when we make a mistake. We're going to correct anything that we can, and we're going to prioritize our business, and we're going to communicate honestly and openly with our customers and our staff. Because if you do that, they will give you the grace to recover from, changes in markets or mistakes that you made. And my dad is just tremendous at that. Everyone knows, he is the most sincere and open person in the business world almost. And when he comes and tells you something, you can trust his word. And hopefully my generation has learned from that. And it actually works well in politics too.
And that's really the core of the American farmer is the ability to pivot or go down a different path, whatever new crop to plant in the soil depending on the temperatures or weather changes. I mean, that's always been by definition their kind of mantra is that we will survive. And so kudos to you and your family, and you do provide a fantastic product, fantastic service, and I'm always in awe of the American farmer, and we don't do enough to make sure that field of endeavor survives at the level that it should. But let's move on to politics. We talked about the legislature a little bit. I think we're the first podcast or your first interview that where you've announced your retirement and you're going to hang up your spurs.
That's my neighbor with the motorcycle.
What's going on?
Well, it was just time. 14 years, I'd already stepped down as House Republican leader, and I had a few reasons for that. First of all, I felt like 5 years, I'd learned that job thoroughly. I thought, a really good leadership team that was going to be able to do very well. And the other thing is, I believe that you have to own your results. And nobody can say that Republicans have done well in elections since 2020, I guess. Well, 2016, really. I had been a co-chair of our House Republican election effort starting in 2012. We recovered from having 30-something members to having 48 members, almost a tie. It was 48 to 50 while I was chair there. And then things just went backwards. And, do I think it's all my fault? No, but I had told people that, you have to be responsible for your results. And I expect other people to, own the results of what they do. And I felt like, after a couple of bad elections, I couldn't really stand up with a lot of credibility and say, I know how to win. I couldn't raise money with the confidence that I needed to have, and I wanted to be an example. In the minority,
Wow.
you understand the most important thing that you can do out of your own free will that no one else can control is the example that you set. And if I want other people to be accountable, then I need to be accountable too. And so that was a part of it as well. And once I stepped down from that position a year ago. I just kind of listened to my gut, and my gut told me, you've done this long enough, JT, and you're having a little trouble feeling as motivated as you used to be, and feeling like you want to go out and listen to people as much as you used to. And if that's the way you're feeling in elected office, then you damn well should get out and let somebody else who's still got that drive and that, you know, a little bit of ambition, but also, you know, sense of mission to take over, because you have a shelf life. Everybody does.
That has to be the most honest answer, and really to hold yourself to account when it's you certainly don't deserve the blame is pretty impressive. And now I understand why you were the minority leader a little more clearly. That was kind of my next question. When you stepped down last year as the minority leader, that was this your plan? You were just gonna, you know, fade off into the sunset, not run for re-election, and just call it a day, if you will.
Well, I thought that's probably what I would do, but I did want to sort of spend a year seeing how it felt. I've spent a third of my adult life doing this, a lot more than I ever thought I would. And I wanted to be sure I was doing the right thing. And it felt absolutely right. I went from loving my job. I like to work, and I've almost never not liked my job. But in the last year, it didn't feel like that. And honestly, you know, politics had become so ugly. I think I probably had kind of hit my limit for listening to the things that people say on both sides. You know, seeing people that think that this is all about what you say instead of what you do, be successful in elections. And also, because I'm on a team, I felt like I couldn't always say what I wanted to say. And now I can do that. I still care about my team, but I don't have any responsibility for it. And I can be a lot more open in sharing my opinions.
And our founders always envisioned of us or public servants or in the legislature or in legislative offices that we would come and serve for a little bit and then go back to our regular day jobs. And so do you feel that just way too many elected leaders just hang on too long?
Well, they certainly do at the national level. I think there's less of that in the Washington State Legislature. In fact, I think sometimes, you know, we lack experience because the turnover is so rapid. It seems like it's around a 25% turnover every election. You know, I feel sometimes, you know, we lost so much background. And when you lose that background, what happens? Well, it means the staff becomes more necessary. And I love our staff. They're very dedicated. But they're not elected. And you also in the legislature lose influence versus the executive. And I'll tell you, I absolutely think at the executive level, there should 12 years is too long. And I don't think I'm the only one that thinks that.
I think the winds are a changing, as they say. So for 14 years, you've probably seen a lot in the legislature. What surprised you the most? You're not running, you know, again. Don't worry.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to select. And honestly, my best friend in the legislature, Joel Kretz, told me one time, JT, you put things behind you faster than anyone I've ever known. And I really do. Sometimes
it's
hard for me to remember because I just want to move on to the next thing. You know, we've lived through these things that no one expected, COVID, and the reaction to COVID, and, you know, the governor clinging to emergency powers beyond, I think, almost any, but maybe one governor in the United States. I've got low expectations for Governor Inslee. That's not the hugest surprise. What I think was the biggest disappointment to me was the fact that the legislature used to stand up for itself.
Yes.
Frank Chop would never have allowed the governor to just run the show the way that he did. But the team aspect of government has become so strong that it just felt like the legislature and the majority that controls the legislature just is totally unwilling to stand up to the governor to express criticism of the governor or the executive branch. I think that's the biggest disappointment that I have. And then I think the other thing that made it easy for me to leave is this sense that although there's a lot of really good people that run, I'm just shocked at the number of people that really shouldn't run, don't really have a heart for this, yet know the right buzzwords to use. Voters appreciate what they say instead of what they do.
Yeah.
And that's a big disappointment, honestly.
Yeah, with Governor Inslee, I don't think you're going to find a lot of fans in this room either. You're right, the legislature did stand for something at some point, and there wasn't this, what I would call, I guess, blind acquiescence where we just gave a blank check and allowed the governor to run roughshod over. You know, we know all the businesses that closed. We know all the churches that were shuttered. We know all the individuals that lost their jobs and essentially lost their lives at some point. So that's a cross he's going to have to bear at some point. I that's my belief system, and you're absolutely right. And I think that office changes hands this year, and I'm certainly going to do everything within my power to make sure that happens. But your last session in Olympia, how was it? Are Republicans making any headway? I see with the
natural
initiatives
gas.
That we got a couple of those not only brought to the floor but passed jointly, I might add. So how are we making headway?
Yeah, I think we are in some arenas, and others we continue to go backwards.
Yeah.
You know, the most important power of the majority in a legislature is they set the agenda. And so, you know, you see lots of bills dropped by Republicans that never get a hearing and will never get voted on. And that's because the majority of the Democrats don't want to vote on those things. They know that they are doing things that are, you know, not good for them in election terms, but they've also learned that they can ignore things and the voters will forgive them because they've become very adept at saying Trump, 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 Republicans are bad. And you know, I think playing the worst kinds of politics, but you know, our Constitution has some protections in it. And one of them is the right of initiative to the legislature, which is not the route that everybody goes. Sometimes they do the initiative straight to the ballot, which has a higher threshold of signatures. But I thought that Brian and Steve Gordon and Kerry Condotta all did a good job of thinking this through and making it plain that these were ideas that appealed to broad parts of Washington State, and it was impossible for Democrats and their leadership to ignore it. Now, the downside is, in terms of elections, they all got a really good vote on public safety, for example. So now every Democrat that voted for the pursuit bill initiative can now say, well, what are you talking about? I'm not soft on crime. I voted for the initiative that restored our right to pursue. You know, and you're going to see that in lots of flyers. You're going to see a ton
sure.
of Democrats that claim that they're really good on crime, and you're already seeing the AG just ignore the fact that he cheered on Democrats as they rolled back protections for everyday law-abiding citizens, and now he pretends that he's going to be in favor of effective policing.
Yeah, see, they play this game where they create the calamity, so they effectively become the killer and then the detective that solves the murder at the same time. It's the Democrats' trick in this state, and it's really they're doing it with an entire generation now with fentanyl. Throw some numbers at you here really quick. Fentanyl set a record of fatal overdoses in 23 in Washington state with 1,082, a 51% increase over the record-setting year of 22. What are your thoughts on that? Where does the blame? I mean, we can shift blame all over the place. We can talk about the border, but there's been a massive shift just these last couple of years since 2020, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think in this and some other issues, instead of practical politics, we've seen ideology get implemented in ways that none of us could have imagined. And I think as a result of, this chaos in our country, it is related to the protests around the death of George Floyd. It is related to ideology that that blames most problems on some kind of racism, and it's looking to remove individual responsibility and create responsibility based on some group that either you joined or were born into. We've had this strange delirium where ideologies that would have been rejected even 10 years ago become bills that are impossible for the majority party, the Democrats, to vote against because they are so vulnerable to charges of racism or some other kind of ideological sin. And so used to be a caucus that had a fair number of moderate people decided that they were going to follow a few people over the cliff and decided that police were bad, that law enforcement was a mistake, that victims were more important, criminals were more important than victims. And sadly, the most tragic part of this had to do with virtually eliminating any penalties for, possession of drugs, drug abuse, drug dealing. And the result is death and destruction. And it's beyond belief. 10 years ago, no one would have believed that this could happen. And one more time, there were dozens of people that were willing to come in and talk about their experience on the streets or with their families. And when it comes to drug addiction and even the death of people from fentanyl and other deadly drugs, there's hardly a family in Washington that doesn't have a story of a lost child or a lost cousin or a lost neighbor. And none of those things mattered. Republicans were so sincere in trying to be part of the solution, and we were just utterly rejected. I appointed the most, collaborative person in the legislature, Gina Mossbrucker, to be our public safety ranking member because I felt like this is an opportunity to work together. And instead of that, she was just ignored. John Braun just was tireless over the Senate in terms of trying to say, look, we don't think that jail or punishment or law enforcement is the first step that you take in addiction. But if you take those things off the table, then you're condemning people to death. And in the end, you're ignoring them. And we know this because, I lost a cousin or I lost a nephew or my stepsister is alive only because she was incarcerated. Mm-hmm. And that gave her a chance to recover. And all those real life lived experiences were just rejected. And thank God we're starting to reverse all that now. But the price was high and it was measured in lives.
And it's going to continue for a while. We're in for a long stretch because another number, Seattle Fire just listed, they averaged 15 overdose calls a day in 2023, and it's up another 25% this year. When you hear things like that, and again, WASPIC, you know who WASPIC is, it's the Association of Police Chiefs and Sheriffs, they've released numbers as well that said murder is up 96% in Washington state since 2019. I guess where I'm going with this question, do the Democrats, do they even take things like crime and violent crime and drugs seriously? Or does it have to affect their family?
I think they take it seriously, but it's what I said a little bit earlier. There's this delirium that has infected many people, and especially people that are elected Democrats. Now, please don't think I'm going to jump up and talk about the perfection of Republicans. I look at Washington, D.C., and I think, there's no way I would stay there. I would be gone so fast, and I'm shocked that they can even get a Speaker of the House right now, because you've got people that don't care about our country. All they care about is their performance. So this is a problem with America and with the two political parties, not just Democrats. But what I understand about Washington right now is there has been this crazy moment in history that's lasted a small number of years now, and I think is turning around a little bit, where ideologies that would have been rejected 5 or 10 years ago have become so powerful that you go straight from an academic exercise into bills that then pass because people are afraid to vote no.
And to your point earlier, so many of these elected leaders, do the exact opposite of what you did. You got into this for a public service. You weren't looking for a job. You weren't looking for a career path. And so they hang around and figure that the only way they stay elected and get funded is to continue on with this nonsense. And those are the folks that we need to really shine a light on, the poison that is really not just killing Washington State, but really killing America, in my opinion. So
how did they?
Hang on, Steve. Was anything of merit that wasn't initiative related accomplished in this past? I know it's a short session, but
yeah, there is always. In fact, the vast majority of bills come through; they get voted on, voted yes by both sides. There's a lot of unanimous bills. Most of them are not highly impactful. But they're important to some people. It doesn't get to the floor unless there are some people that feel like it's important. And I don't know what the count was, but there were several hundred that were worthwhile. I can think of a couple that I was involved in that are not earth-shattering, but may make a difference in the future. We've talked about, regulations that affect farming. I care an awful lot about fish runs, in part because I'm a fisherman myself. In part because I feel like my family's been here for a long time and maybe we've been part of the habitat problem. And I represent the Nisqually tribe. And if you care about the Constitution, you care about treaties that the U.S. government signed with, what were foreign nations at the time of the treaties. So we got a few things done there. We are looking at avian predation. Because that's a big problem. And sometimes the changes that we've made to the environment have made it a lot easier for avian predation to take way more than their share of salmon. And if we can solve that problem, maybe we don't have to blame it all on landowners. We also, I think, found some other ways to help fund culvert replacement, sort of like adopt a highway process. I had a bill that I asked a freshman colleague to help run that allows people to get some public credit for helping to fund these fish passage blockages that are so expensive to remove. So there's a couple of little examples. Everyone has a few examples of their own. Those are good, but we also see for every 100 good little bills, there's one or two really bad big bills, and those overwhelm everything.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, was one of those bad bills was, it did get pushed through, which was to ban natural gas being attached to new buildings, which I think is just evil, criminal, and I had contacted Cindy Ryu when they tried to push this through several years ago. And fortunately enough, people said no, and they didn't get it through. This time they did, And that is such a destructive bill because it's one of the cleanest forms of energy you can imagine, and a lot of us rely on that. So how did that take place? I mean, it's ideology, I understand, but it's insanity.
Yeah, you know, I've been mystified by some things in that bill for the last 2 years. Year before this, it came up at the last minute about 11 o'clock at night when everyone had been told it was dead. I jumped up with no preparation. And one of the things I said, this is the most poorly written bill in 14 years I've ever seen get serious consideration. And I believe that was true. And they went and fixed a few problems, but there are so many consequences. And, you know, we all have experience that would illuminate some of those. For a builder, it's understanding how much more expensive it's going to be to build homes now. And people tell us that we've got a housing crisis. And I agree. This just makes housing more expensive. You know, I'm aware that a whole bunch of people depend on backup generators. And oftentimes the most reliable fuel source for a backup generator is natural gas. And a huge part of our infrastructure is backed up by natural gas generators. And, you know, the people that are pursuing this have just decided over the course of a few years that anything that is based on fossil fuels has to be eliminated. Whether it makes a bit of difference to the environment, whether it makes a bit of difference to the long-term temperature trends, it doesn't matter. This is my ideology. I'm tired of waiting, and I'm not going to support any consumption of carbon anymore. Now, I'm not quoting myself here. I'm quoting the people that propose these bills. One more time, it's not carefully weighing what's the cost of this bill? What are the consequences? Is there anything we haven't thought of? It's just my ideology is we shouldn't be burning any carbon. That's what the governor tells us we have to do. So we're gonna pass this bill.
Sure, it's where the waterfall comes from, right? It's whatever comes out of Davos. That's the talking points for the progressives, and that's the end of it. And that's how you get the only way you get funded and get to stay in office is if you continue to proliferate this ideology. And it's been going on for decades. I mean, we're watching it just cripple Washington in a very short amount of time, including many of the businesses. As a practical matter, are there any really any workable Democrats on the other side in Olympia these days?
Yeah. You know, in my retirement letter, I said, look, I've got confidence that we're going to turn this around we're going to turn it around because history isn't linear. It's cyclical. That's one of my basic faiths. And as you get older, you learn that. When you're young, you think everything goes in the same direction forever. You know, I used to talk about how bad Frank Chop was. I think a lot of Frank Chop now. I think a lot of Larry Springer. I think a lot of Mike Chapman. These are people that I've worked with, and often they've run Republican bills because they knew that Republican bills wouldn't pass. So they turned them into good Democratic policy, and we voted for them. And there's more of those people than you know. Now, here's the thing. Just like the best Republicans, nobody hears of them because you don't get attention for being a good legislator. You get attention for being Matt Gaetz, you know, or someone who just rants. And ranting doesn't solve anything. I used to tell my caucus, the more you talk, the less people listen. So when you have something to say, make sure that you know what you're talking about. Say it impactfully and don't talk about the stuff that you don't know about. But, you know, today's world actually likes people to rant. So, you know, their names, you don't know the people that accomplish a lot. And I just named a few of them, and I could name lots of Republicans too. Andrew Barkus, very, very effective. Representative Waters, Representative Jacqueline Maycumber, you know, my successor, Drew Stokesbury, Ed Orcutt, one of the hardest working most sincere people I know. All these are not everyday names. It's because they're working hard and they prioritize accomplishing something over getting attention.
You know, I appreciate that actually, and your willingness to say, hey, it's not just one sided, both sides bear a brunt of the responsibility here. We don't have a lot of time left, and it always goes quick. Does a Republican get elected governor in 2024?
Well, I think the odds are better because we've got, I believe, a great candidate in Dave Reichert. That's who I think will come out of the primary. He's been elected many times in King County. He'll do better there than previous candidates have done. You know, Dave is the kind of person that I respect, and I've spent a lot of time with him over the last few months. He's not a big talker either. He's not a show off. He's not a ranter. In fact, people complain that, you know, they don't get to cheer enough for him.
He's too vanilla. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we could use a few workhorses. We don't all have to be show horses. I'm not saying he looks like a horse, but I know that he is a hard, hard worker. And I know that he doesn't require the spotlight. And, you know, if we're going to recover from the crazy spot that we're in, it's going to be people that work hard, not people that rant. And that's what I respect about Dave.
Yeah, I've known him for a little over 20 years now in the law enforcement field, and he's always been that guy, certainly electable, certainly in Congress, sheriff, just the guy that gets the job done. That's kind of the label he has. And even in a Trump presidential election year, I still think that a Dave Reichert does get elected governor because of his abilities and prior history here in Washington State. I think at this point it's got to be a no-brainer. Something has to change. So last question, what's next for JT Wilcox?
Well, I'm doing a little bit of work for some people in the natural resource realm, and I think I'm going to keep doing that. I care an awful lot about forestry. I care about salmon. I like to fish and hunt. And I'm going to stay active in those things. They don't need me at Wilcox Farms. We've got a great management team of my younger brother and younger cousins and the fifth generation coming in. But I live here and I still stay active. You know, that's it for now. I'm working my tail off, cutting a lot of firewood. I just like to work. So I'm going to be doing that till the day they haul me off in a stretcher, probably.
And I say save some of the firewood cutting for the 7-year-old grandchild. I'm sure it'll do them good.
I bought Emma a hatchet. It caused a little bit of a stir at her birthday party, but you know, I want my kids to be workers too. I've got all kinds of respect for people that that think for a living and people that have academic success, but you know, if we lose contact with how it feels to accomplish things with your own two hands, we look down our nose at blue collar workers, then we're lost. So I'm going to be damn sure that my family doesn't lose respect for that part of life.
Amen to that, brother. How can JT? How can the folks get a hold of you if they want to?
Well, you know, I've been doxxed so many times. I could suggest a few people that would probably just give you my phone number. But, you know, at this point, my legislative contact stuff still works. You can find me on Facebook and Twitter. And I've got a little consulting company called Wilcox Strategies, and you can find me there, too.
Well, excellent. Well, thanks again. Thanks so much for being a great sport, taking the time out of your busy day and joining the show today. We truly do appreciate you. I wish you all the best in your retirement and your wood chopping and your grandchild raising. It's a great field to be in, and we're blessed to have it. So thank you for all your service. Thank you for all your hard works. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your service, too, and for what you're doing here. I really appreciate your contributions, and I value our friendship.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that, and you have a great day, and God bless. Friends, we are going to be right back. We're going to take a short break. Don't go away. My closing monologue is still coming, and you'll get the way I see it. Thank you. Friends, welcome back to the show. What a great guest. I admire and respect Representative Wilcox, and I have for some time. He's a good man right there, good family man. Thankful to have him on the show. My opening monologue, if you weren't here for that, really centered on elections and the lack of people's understanding as to the role of government and why it's important to make sure that people of character hold these elected positions. One of the most serious challenges facing local governments today is the continued assault on cities' rights in progressive cities and states. During Washington State's previous session, House Bill 1110 was passed and signed into law. I'll wager that most none of you have heard of it. It's one of the most aggressive and overly invasive bills to emanate from the state capitol, and here's why. 1110 seeks to undermine all local authority and mandate massive population growth and housing density in small communities. Never in Washington's history has the use of preemption been so prevalent in a city's day-to-day operation than it is today. And for those of you that might be unaware of what preemption is, it's essentially the use of state law to restrict or nullify municipal codes and ordinances. Essentially, I would say commandeering autonomous local authority. State constitutions were specifically constructed to make sure that that doesn't happen. Yet here we are. When preemption is used so broadly as it is today, it becomes counterintuitive to the core wants and needs of the people. And then it becomes a coercive method to substitute state priorities for local policymaking. They've effectively taken preemption and used it as a punitive measure to limit local authority. Bills like 1110 have so many ambiguities that favor the state, it'll force every city to alter its vision.
Yep.
Which, by the way, is a process that is constitutionally reserved for its local elected representatives and its residents. There's no doubt in my mind this will alter the character and charm that past city planners and elected leaders worked so tirelessly to create. But friends, this is how progressive Democrats destroy communities. This is their template. This is their business model, if you will. This is why it's also the utmost importance that you exercise your right to vote in every election. State actors are unlikely to slow down until forced to do so or forced out. We must have elected lawmakers willing to utilize their resources to combat overreach. This includes anticipatory and reactive lobbying as well, because elected representatives should not be advocates for political parties. It stands in stark contrast to their oath of office. And if the citizens want to alter a city's vision, it should be left to the people, not some fundamentalist bureaucrat in Olympia. You, the citizen, must be proactive in your own success, and it requires actually very little. You, the voter, must be actively involved and use the ballot box as a mechanism to hold these electeds accountable. Our system of governance was designed with you as the check and balance. Community activism is the only way our communities survive going forward. Otherwise, Washington simply becomes another bankrupt California. Friends, that is it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed, and I certainly hope that you got something out of it. What a great guest. Thanks so much for tuning in. Once again, let's say thank you to Representative J.T. Wilcox for taking the time from his busy schedule to join us today. We wish him well in his last days in the legislature and any future endeavors as well. He truly is an advocate of the people. And I think, honestly, what I probably appreciate the most about his tenure of service is that he didn't go to Olympia looking for a job. He looked to fill a void. Friends, that's the definition of a public servant. Kudos to him for wanting to make a difference in his community. Also, let's say thanks to Steve, the producer, for all the work he does behind the mic. And lastly, I want to thank you, the Mill Creek View audience. Just listening is huge. It's no easy trick bringing you the truth in today's America, but as I always say, I will always endeavor to do so. So until next time, this is Mill Creek City Councilman Vincent Cavalieri wishing you all God's peace. Take us home, Steve.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.